The 100 Years' War, the De Guiscolin period, challenges to the English government in 1377. Well, last time we looked at what the French were doing. They're planning on attacking England from just about every angle. But we can't look at England's prepared response because the English have another challenge to their government that's going to have to be dealt with before they can do that. Now, 1377 was the year of the English King's Jubilee. By now, Edward III had become a remote figure in his own kingdom, moving at irregular intervals between the royal manors around London and keeping through the shadows, out of sight of his subjects. There's some evidence of an improvement in his health in the early days of 1377, but he seems to have remained incapable of giving more than passing attention to public affairs, and access to him was strictly controlled by his household. There are vivid but pathetic glimpses of his life. Alice Pearce, a manipulative presence standing at the head of the king's bed as officials came before him, the chamberlain quarreling with petitioners outside his room until the king came to the door to find out what the heck was going on, and then silenced them by shaking the petitions out of their hands. The old man, propped upright in his chair at formal audiences, looked like a statue and unable to speak as his sons and selected bishops, officials, and courtiers stood around him. A hooded barge bearing the prostrate king up the Thames from Havering to Shin seems to have been, during the sitting of Parliament, making its way through the mass of boats lying off the Palace of Westminster, all filled with people trying to get a last glimpse of him. Parliament opened at Westminster in the absence of the king on January the 27th, 1377. That happens to be my birthday, but not in 1377. The council had been forced to summon it by shortage of funds to fight a war that now seemed inevitable. According to Thomas Walsingham, John of Gaunt brought pressure to bear on the electors of the shires to return more amiable knights than those of 1376. But even without interference, the imminence of the threat from France would probably have been enough to produce a more compliant mood, shall we say. The open address was delivered by the newly appointed chancellor, Adam Mutton, Bishop of St. David's. His words were calculated to darken the menace and loosen men's purses. He dwelt on the enemies now encircling England, France, Scotland, Castile. The council, he said, had received several letters and private reports about the progress of French and Castilian naval preparations. The English king's barges were already being mobilized. A comprehensive program of requisitions began in early February while Parliament was sitting. Yet the main difference between the new Parliament and its predecessor lay not in the personnel or the attitudes of the Commons, but in the position of the Lords. Their support for parliamentary revolution in 1376 had been indispensable, but they were no longer inclined to favor a radical program of reform in the face of the government's obvious financial need. This time, the intercommuning committee, which the Lords appointed to assist the Commons in their deliberations, was stuffed with government supporters. Even the Earl of March seems to have rallied to the government's cause. In most respects, both houses showed themselves willing enough to do the government's business. Gaunt's counter-revolution was completed with the reversal of all proceedings in the last Parliament against Alice Pearce and Richard Lyons, his associates, and the restoration of most of their sequestered assets. A few members of the Commons, including some veterans of the previous Parliament, raised their voices to protest about the treatment of Peter de la Mare, but they were soon cowed in the silence. The leadership of the opposition passed from the Commons to an unlikely coalition of the Church and citizens of London. The leading figure among the government's clerical opponents was William Courtenay, an impulsive, ambitious, but extremely able young son of the Earl of Devon. Courtenay had recently been appointed at the age of 34 to the bishopric of London, a promotion which he probably owed to the patronage of the Black Prince. He was already known as an outspoken opponent of royal taxation and a vocal enemy of John of Gaunt. He had sat on the intercommuting committee of the Good Parliament and on the short-lived permanent council that emerged from it. He had also acted as William of Wykeham's counsel at his trial. None of these things can have endeared him to the ministry. Courtenay's continued acceptance of the program of the Good Parliament became quite early in the Parliament of 1377, when he raised objections to the grant of any subsidies at all, even with the war about to restart. At least three bishops supported him. Their opposition intensified when the Southern Convocation assembled in the traditional meeting place at St. Paul's in London on February the 3rd, a week after the opening of Parliament at Westminster. The presiding bishop, Archbishop Sudbury, was a dependable supporter of the government and made no secret of that fact. Walsingham called him a hireling drunk with the poison of greed. But Sudbury proved quite unable to manage one of the most unruly clerical assemblies in many years. The first bone of contention was the position of William Wickham, who the government had refused to allow to come within 20 miles of Westminster. At Courtenay's urging, Convocation refused to transact any business till the government relented and allowed him to join their deliberations. At Courtenay's urging again, they opened proceedings for heresy against the royal clerk and protege of John of Gaunt's, John Wycliffe. Wycliffe would later become a much more celebrated figure than he was in January of 1377, but he was already the author of some government-inspired tracts and a remarkable academic treatise, De Civili Domino, of the Temporal Power, which advocated the political subordination of the church to the civil powers and the use of its property for public purposes. For a few days, Wycliffe's prosecution, like Wickham's, acquired a symbolic importance in the eyes of all the main protagonists, for the reasons which had little connection with either the man or his views. Courtenay and his supporters call Wycliffe's writing signs of what they perceived to be wider political threat to the autonomy of the church. For his part, Gaunt saw the heresy charges as an indirect attack on himself. The other force involved in the confrontation was the London mob. London has been a significant factor in the revolutions of the 13th century and in the deposition of Edward III. Yet its reemergence as a force in English politics during the last three decades of the 14th century took John of Gaunt's generation by complete surprise. With an estimated population of 45,000 souls, London was only about a quarter of the size of Paris, but it was still among the largest European cities at the time, with urban unrest becoming an endemic problem for most Western monarchs. The city's oligarchic organization and social divisions made it as vulnerable to any of them to crime and disorder. Political power was concentrated in the hands of the mayor and the aldermen, they themselves drawn from a small group of rich merchants belonging to the major guilds. The mass of the population consisted of unenfranchised apprentices, journeymen, labormen, servants, and beggars, most of whom lived close to subsistence levels at the best of times. The physical fabric of the city aggravated the natural tensions of this world. People lived packed together in dense networks of narrow lanes and alleys, interrupted by the gardens of monasteries, churchyards, and aristocratic mansions. The city's ancient and extensive libraries deprived the king's ministers of any real measure of control over this crowd, an intensely political place. There was no equivalent in London of the parish Châtelet, installed in the heart of the city, were its royal judges, jailers, and sergeants. The only visible signs of royal power were at the edges of the city, the Tower of London in the east, the royal fortress, arsenal, and zoo, and the Marshalsea, the King's Bench prison south of London Bridge at Southwark. London had done well by the war. It was an important entrepot for the sale of armor, equipment, and looted objects. The building trades had prospered by magnificent spending of successful captains returning from France and merchant capitalists grown fat on the profits of the government financial operations. Calais was virtually a London colony. Yet Londoners felt the decline of English arms since 1369 as much as any group of Englishmen. The disruption of English trade and shipping had badly affected the city's interests. The return of heavy annual taxes bore hard on mercantile cities, which paid both parliamentary tenths and customs duties. The city government had promoted most of the charges against Lyons and his associates in the good parliament, and when they were convicted, it had gleefully degraded them from their offices in the city. The Duke of Lancaster was not popular in London. He suffered the sobriquet reserved for all politicians with high pretensions and more power than status. As an effective ruler of England, the principal commander of the armies, and the author of its recent policies towards France, it was perhaps inevitable, that he should become the focus of popular resentment. Bishop Courtenay's challenge to the government in Convocation provided an unexpected catalyst for these emotions. The lampoons against the Duke of Lancaster appeared in public places. Banners were carried about insulting his name. Posters repeating the old fable that he was the son of a Ghent butcher were nailed to the doors of St. Paul and Westminster Abbey. John of Gaunt responded to the challenge with all the injured majesty and impulsive anger which his staff had managed to restrain during the sessions of the good Parliament. On February the 19th, 1377, he proposed a bill in Parliament which would have effected a revolution in the city's relations with the crown, transferring the powers of the mayor and the aldermen in matters of public order to a royal captain and conferring on the Marshal of England the same power to make arrests within their jurisdiction as he already enjoyed in most of the realm. On the same day, Gaunt personally escorted Wycliffe to St. Paul's Cathedral to meet his judges. He came mob-handed with the marshal, and Henry Lord Percy, his baton, held before him. Four doctors hired for Wycliffe's defense, and a mass of noblemen and liveried retainers. Inside the cathedral, he and Percy heckled the proceedings and exchanged undignified abuse with the bishop. On the following day, London erupts in the violence. So, we're going to have a little more internal activity here with John of Gaunt. So, we'll see how this goes next time. Now, the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.